If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
The horror of him, he has a folksy appeal to him. And I think it may hit people different depending on where you are in the country or where you grew up in the country. Bob grew up, you know, there in that area. I grew up in that general area too. People did kind of talk like that. I feel like I knew many of people that on the surface, you know, were kind of Gacy, like a lot of used car dealers. But you know, there was that level of, you know, you didn't quite know what was going on with some people behind the curtain, and you know, Gacy, obviously, it was far more extreme than anyone could have imagined. I wonder at the end of the day, and I'll ask you this, Michael, do you think John knew exactly who he was, or was he just such a chameleon? He's always just changing skins because he was so uncomfortable in his own that he didn't know who he was. We see it in the Brian Koberger case, where he seemed to be always taking different snippets of different horrible characters from the past. I mean, including even fictional ones like Norman Bates and the American Psycho character to make up who he is when we look at who he became with the horrible Idaho murders. There are seemingly remnants of that here with Gacy, of the constant chameleon, constantly, I'm going to play the room to whoever the crowd is the best I can for whatever my narcissistic needs are. Again, long question, but do you think John knew who he was?
I don't think he knew who he was. I don't think he had a real level of self-awareness in that sense. But I do think he knew what he was doing.
Yeah.
And I do think that I don't buy into the theory that he was like killing off parts of himself that he hated, or that he wasn't comfortable in his skin. I think if he was born straight, he would have killed women. I think he was a psychopath. I think he was a true psychopath. Yeah. And I think that, you know, he claimed that when he killed Tim McCoy, his first victim, he had an orgasm. Mm-hmm. And I think like there was a real bloodlust thing. I think it got him off.
Yeah.
And I think he was like hunting. He was out every night. I mean, he killed 33 people that we know of, and that's a huge number, but he picked up thousands of guys.
Yeah.
He let a lot of them go. He tortured a lot of them. Some of them he brought them back to his house and just talked and got high and passed out on the couch. I mean, he was always seeking something: booze, drugs, sex. He, I think he was like an addict in that sense. Mm. And I don't believe that he was killing any of his victims because they were gay or he thought they were gay. It was always if they cheated him out of money, if they changed the price on him, if they said they were going to tell his neighbors or his friends that he was picking up boys, if you know, they were blackmailing him. It was always like if he felt he was being wronged, if he was being a victim, if he was being backed into a corner, then he would kill someone. So it was always just about him. He was a narcissist. It was
just massive.
Yes.
And it was all just self-protection. Like if he felt like, even with Rob Peast, he said he was probably going to let him go. And then Rob said, oh, gee, Mr. Gacy, I thought you were going to kill me there for a second. He was like, yeah, he planted that one seed you don't want planted. And
Yeah.
Patrick, how difficult is it to write for a character like that? That, I mean, obviously we have the documented history, but you go in, you dramatize it, you're creating the dialogue that we don't know what happened in a lot of cases of just what was this man like? What was his interactions with human beings? And someone who is kind of all over the board with their chameleon-like tendencies, not just here's the character. How was that difficult to dive into his mind and go there?
The one thing that I'll say on that is, and I joke that I have like sociopathic tendencies because I've done several pieces of true crime. I'm doing more true crime.
Yeah.
And I don't ever really get affected by it. I have a story I'll share in a moment, but in terms of compartmentalization and doing the work, I just do the work. Mm-hmm. In terms of crafting the dialogue and helping or having other writers help me craft the dialogue with the other scripts, you know, it really, so while there's no world in which we know for sure what conversations were had, if you do enough research, and we just waded into research, you get snippets of conversations because you're if not whole conversations, and you're able to sort of piece together a general idea of who people were and what they said and how they responded to things. And specifically with Gacy, as I alluded to before, my biggest challenge at the beginning was figuring out how to not write him as a serial killer. Like mm-hmm. that was the biggest challenge. And I do want to share a quick anecdote about Michael. So at the time that he read, and then even in like the early days of rehearsals and things like that, it was all sort of the masks of Gacy, right? To use what Michael said, right? There was this one rehearsal that we did with actually the young man who played Tim McCoy. And we were in this like conference room that we converted into a rehearsal space for a second on the lot. And I was sitting in the back of the room at a table with a couple of other producers and writers. And it was in that rehearsal for the first months into the process that I saw behind the mask for the first time on Michael. And because I'd just been spending so much time in the masks that was all we had been doing. And in this rehearsal where he is sitting on a couch, it's just Michael and the young man who was playing Tim McCoy, and the actor was leaning forward because he was eating something and he was pretending to eat something. And Michael was leaning back. And this is from a later episode. And so we at the table could see Michael's performance for the first time as the mask dropped. And it was like, and we knew, we all looked at each other. First of all, it was chilling. It was genuinely chilling. But secondly, we knew it worked. Like we knew in that moment that because of all the work we had done in trying to craft this, and I will use the term affability, right? This affable character, we knew that that moment that the mask dropped, that we'd accomplished what we were trying to accomplish, like perfectly. And Michael just, it was the most haunting, terrifying, simple, like it was so, so simple to us, to him, I'm sure it was very complicated, but it was just absolutely brutal. That moment that the mask dropped. So I will say that finding that balance between the two was the most challenging aspect of the job that I had as writers and that I think our fellow writers had as well.
Did you have that exact same experience when they were feeling the mask was dropping, Michael? What was going through your mind as that was happening?
You know, I don't know how to say this in the right way, but it actually wasn't complicated. I think like I knew that there was this part of him that when no one was looking was very different from all the other parts of him when someone was looking. Mm-hmm. And that the man in private was like a bit like a shark, you know, just stalking his prey. And in a weird way, like that's not complicated.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a,
it's the nature of who he was. And I mean, to others looking in, Yeah. When others look in, when we look at it, we're like, how does, because it's like, it's nothing we would do as human beings as ourselves. But when you have to go behind the prism of that person and go, okay, how is this person seeing reality? What's motivating this person? That's what's spooky about it. But once you get it, once you know the person, it's like, oh, that's like A plus B equals C in this person's mind. And that is, yeah.
Yeah. Like, let me jump in. And I, in my estimation, he was the most terrifying apex predator that ever existed in terms of his ability to be able to do that. Just and Michael, you nailed it. I mean, the dude was literally a shark, you know. And I mean, the man never slept. Like his ability to be able to function in terms of, because you know, PDM was pretty successful. I think by today's standards, you know, he was making $500,000 a year with this business he had, which he traveled with constantly. And then, and as Patrick said, I mean, he hunted every night. There was never a time when he wasn't out. So, you know, in that thought process and really kind of when, and I don't know if you guys were able to get into, like, I'm assuming you do with Peace and, you know, everything that he did in that moment and that, as soon as he laid his eyes on Rob Peace, he knew, you know, leaving the, you know, his Bible, which was his appointment book, behind intentionally. And then Torf calls him and says, hey, John, you left your book here. And then him waiting until 10 minutes before 9 to go back, you know, and then Miss Peace and him just kind of like ships passing in the night with her son going out and following Gacy and her coming in. It's, I mean, the dude was heavily premeditated, you know, but it would be in the moment. Like, he didn't have to premeditate for days. Like, he could premeditate something in a moment because he was just so patterned in what he did. And like, one of the things I wanted to ask you, Patrick, in terms of when you guys get to the kind of the investigation part, because when I interviewed all these old Des Plaines cops, which was a fascinating experience for me because, you know, my dad's involvement in the case, but you know, and I'm very tough in my podcast on the Chicago police. You know, the Chicago police in general, in my estimation, are directly responsible for probably about 29 of those homicides. I lay it out in, I think, my third episode when after he'd killed Johnny Bukovich. And I'm like, man, they had everything they needed. Like when you guys are kind of researching it, and I had talked to Tracy quite a bit, who had done the documentary going into my podcast, and she had given me a lot of her research going into it. And, you know, and I knew she had a different angle than I was going to take when I was doing the pod, but, you know, and I really did want to focus on the investigation. Do you guys kind of delve into the lack of police work by Chicago police in particular and their, just their view of homosexuality back at that point in time and the frustration that these parents felt by just having these cops over and over. And so, you know, like, just saying your kid just ran away, you know, and then, you know, having a brief conversation where the couple of times when Gacy was on the radar and he's just saying, oh yeah, like he came and got his last check and he told me he was fucking off to California, you know, but the kid leaves his car, his prized possession behind in his wallet. You know, it's like, are you guys able to get into that? Because I'm really excited. I obviously haven't seen the screener and there's just, it's such ripe territory.
So with each of the shows that I've done so far and the shows that are on the docket for the future, there is a theme that runs through them very purposefully, which is systemic failure. And with Dr. Death, it was the failure of the medical community. With Girl from Plainville, it was there, all of these missed opportunities in terms of mental health. And with Devil in Disguise, it is probably one third of the show is analyzing dramatically, right? I mean, we have 8 episodes to be able to do it, but that is a massive part of it. And what's interesting about it is that you sort of have the police on two different sides, right? Which is, you've got Chicago PD and the failure of them to stop him, as you laid out, and I won't repeat. Yes, we do absolutely explore that. But on the flip side of it, you also have all of these police who are in the pit, who are trying to figure out how many victims there are that are genuinely become broken heroes because of the time they spend down there. And so what I appreciate about this story is that we're not demonizing, right? We are simply telling the truth. And the truth was Chicago PD did not have the communication, if you want to be as generous as you can possibly be, to be able to share what John Wayne Gacy was doing. And on the flip side, you had a deeply, deeply prejudiced department, which was not just about homophobia, but it was about socioeconomic conditions as well. Criminal backgrounds of kids, right, that they just dismissed. And then on the other side, you do have these police who are genuinely trying to do a good. And so we do explore both sides of those coins because we don't want to demonize. We want to just tell as close to a version of the truth of the story as we can possibly do in 8 episodes of storytelling.
Awesome. Yeah.
And let the people who are going to be demons, basically, by their own actions. Right. Reality in a case like this, oftentimes it's scarier. It's more disturbing than what one could even put on a screen. Did you run into that at all? Were there any moments here when you're going through the story and you're because obviously there's a lot here. There's only so much, you know, only so many pieces of the story that can fit into the show. Did you ever run into any moments where you're like, this is reality, but I don't know that it's so out there, it's so extreme as to what his actions were, that this might be hard for them to even grasp, or fearing that the audience is going to think we added this in for dramatization, but it's really the reality of what he did.
You want me to take that, Michael, or do you want to take it?
Yeah, go for it.
It's one of the short answer to your question is no. Mm-hmm. But there's a reason for it. Like, because we are not showing any of the murders, we are not showing any of the rapes, we are not showing any of the assaults. Because we are leaving that on the side, the show becomes about something more. Yeah. And so I genuinely believe that if we leaned into dramatized what actually happened, first of all, I wouldn't have done the show. Mm-hmm. Because I do think it's too extreme. I think that it's unnecessary. I think it's gratuitous. I think it's salacious. Like I from the very beginning had no interest in doing it. There is nothing about this story, if you show it, if you really show it, that deserves to be on television.
Sure.
And it would be a disservice to the lives of the victims to show it, and to not just the living, but the deceased family members as well. There is nothing about him that should be, and what he did, that should be shown on television. But there is absolutely a reason to, as I said at the very beginning, to show the absolute wreckage that he left in his wake. And I'll say one last thing. There are a couple of moments in the show where we very strategically, cinematically walked up to the line and then stepped away from it. And you'll see it when you see it. And I've been in the edit for 8 billion years, it seems, on this. And every time we get to that moment, I think we've seen it, even though we haven't seen it. And I think that audiences are going to fill in a lot of the gaps on their own. Sorry, Michael, please go ahead.
No, I was just going to agree. I think it's scarier to not show.
Yeah.
I do have to say, because I'm a consumer of true crime, I do feel like Patrick and I are going to get a ton of messages from people who know this case really well, being like, this didn't happen, or that didn't happen, or that's not exactly how it went down. I just want folks to know, we really put a ton of research into this, all of us. And when things are dramatized in just 8 episodes, even though that sounds like a lot of time with a case this big, you know, we just had to condense some things.
Sure.
And, you know, so there are just things, but all of those were conscious choices that we all talked about. We're like, okay, this character is now this sort of amalgamation of these like four different detectives. And like, it's just the way we have to do it to make a show in a certain amount of time. Yeah. But it was all done consciously. I can't wait, Bob, for you to see it and for you to see the actor, Michael Esper, who plays your dad, who's a dear friend of mine, old friend of mine, New York actor. He does a kick-ass job playing Bob Mata.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome. I'm excited. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and I know you guys got a roll, but when is this thing dropping?
October 16th.
Yep. Woo! All right. It's
just all eight, yeah. 8 episodes available on October 16th on Peacock.
Awesome.
It's it's certainly one of those where reality is scarier than horror, and if you want to watch something to scare you in October, this would be the one. I was watching it last night on my porch, full moon. There was some fog out, the clouds were going, a little dim light. Like this is good. It unfortunately was reality, that you're watching of obviously a dramatization of reality, but it really sucks you in. It really paints, I think, one of the most compelling pictures of this case that's been done. Bravo, you guys. It's quite amazing. Patrick McManus, Michael Chernus, Bob Mana, you guys, thank you for joining us. There you go. October 16th, you said, correct, on Peacock?
That's right.
Drop date. So be ready to watch that. It's when everybody is going to be talking about. Thank you guys for joining us.
Thanks, and
talking. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We will talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done. If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.